You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Leonard LoPate, according to Robert McCrum's latest book, Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language, approximately half of the world's population has some acquaintance with English. How did that happen, and what does it mean for modern society, culture, and the economics of the globe? Globish is published by Norton, and author Robert McCrum is here to talk about it on The Leonard LoPate Show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Who actually coined the word globish?
The word itself was coined by a Frenchman, nice irony, in the 1990s. But I've taken it on from his original definition. I mean, my interest in this subject began a long time ago. I was involved with a series, which some of your listeners may remember, called The Story of English in the 1980s. And I sort of followed this, what you might call breaking cultural news, for the last 25 years. And about 5 years ago, I began to think I wanted to explore the idea of a global lingua franca. And I couldn't think what to call it. And then I came across this Jean-Paul Nerrier, who'd written about Globish in Japan. And so I asked him whether I could borrow his term, and I've used it.
Let's break that down a little bit for those who were absent that day in class. Lingua franca.
The lingua franca is, of course, the language that's used you know, internationally and was originally used to describe Latin across the medieval Europe, and now will be used to describe English as being everyone's second language.
And this Frenchman that you talked about, initially Globish was 1,500 words and had no grammar and was very specific. You've taken that to broaden it in what ways?
Well, let me just go back a little bit. I mean, the Frenchman who'd coined the term was in Japan. He made one brilliant observation. He saw that non-native speakers, people who didn't have English as a mother tongue, did better when they spoke to other non-native speakers than when they spoke to Americans or Brits or Australians. And so he decided that there was something about the non-native language, either simplified language, which was doing better than the language that you and I are using now. And so he coined the term Globish. And then he took it further. He has a language program, books and so forth. And he has, as you say, a limited vocabulary of 1,500 words, which is very similar to the vocabulary used by Voice of America in its radio shows. But I don't really subscribe to that view. I wanted to say that this combination of global capitalism, the internet, and all the changes that happened in the last 20 years are the things which have made what I've called Globish, you know, a very important phenomenon, because, you know, the long history of the language, say 200 or 300 years back, there was a period when the British Empire and British English was the dominant force, roughly in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, the dominant version was American English, the Pax Americana. And in 1989, with the fall of the wall, something happened. And there began to be a kind of a third phase, which is why I've taken the term Globish. And the third phase was the use of English by people around the world, in which the language was decoupled from the associations of imperialism and the Pax Americana. And so this third phase, it's much more neutral. People use English all the time in crisis situations in Iran, in Greece, in Iceland, you know, wherever there's a situation where they need to get the message out internationally, it's Globish that they turn to.
It's a bit of a surprise, because one hears of non-English speaking people or don't speak it at first that it's supposed to be a really difficult language to learn.
It is difficult. Well, all languages are difficult to learn at a certain point, but it also,
that's true.
But at its core, it's Anglo-Saxon, it's Old English core, it's going back, you know, 1,000 years and more. It's very simple. And words like man and hus and drink, which are Anglo-Saxon words, are the words that we in any English sentence that we use today, 90% or 80% will be Anglo-Saxon, Old English. And take someone like President Obama, who has a very wide range of roots. I mean, Kansas, Kenya, Hawaii, Indonesia. His speech is incredibly Globish. Those phrases like change we can believe in, yes we can, that's Globish. And if you look at the first inaugural, it's complex ideas expressed incredibly simply, in very elegant, and he's a very elegant writer, or his speechwriter is, somebody is. But he's using simple terms to get over a difficult message. And so you could say that he's like the first Globish president.
So far, we've talked about speaking English globally. Is writing it and reading it also on the incline, or are they separate?
I think they're separate. I think the what's called the oral standard is different from the written standard. And clearly, as any of us know, if you go to an airport, you'll see people using Globish all over the place in different ways. If you say to me, can I give an example of it? No, I really can't, because it's what people do when they're in a fix. They turn to English, whatever they have of it, to get themselves out of that fix, and that they make it up. But at the same time, you know, you have international newspapers, New York Times, the London Times, the BBC, ABC, and so forth, who are projecting a written standard across the world, which is on a different scale. At a different level.
I think the last 10 or 15 or 20 years of this story is incredibly interesting and maybe the most important part. But you do start early. You start about the genesis of the language. It's in the documentary series that you were a part of, the story of English. Mm-hmm. Give us that little background that this little British Isle should have this language. Well, how did that come about?
Well, it's also quite a long story.
I'll take the short version today.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, for the language purists who are about to write in to complain, because these programs always generate complaints. People always complain about language. English is not. There is no such thing as pure English. It comes from Germany. It comes from Denmark. It comes from Holland. It's a mongrel. It's a hybrid. It's a mixture of actually German, the language of the Angles, French. Latin. It's a real mixture, and it was forged over roughly 1,000 years, so that by the time you get to Shakespeare, you've got a which is what should we say, 1600,
right?
You know, at this, roughly the same time as the settlement of America, you have at the point at which the first settlers come, the first pilgrims come to the East Coast, the Mayflower settlers. You have a language which is more. I mean, you could more or less. I mean, William Bradford, who wrote the account of the settlement in Plymouth, is writing in English, which is pretty intelligible, but 100 years before wouldn't have been intelligible. So it's a long evolution. And then you've got trade, imperialism. Somebody once said that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. And in a way, that's the whole story. You know, if you've got an army and navy behind you, you're in good shape. And then there's the extraordinary accident. You know, we have the English settlement of America, and then the Declaration of Independence, the separation of America from Britain. And so you have a unique situation because the British Empire was followed by the Pax Americana, the 20th century version. And for the first time in human history, you have one empire, the British Empire, being followed by another empire using essentially the same language and having essentially the same language and culture. And that's absolutely unique. And so that accident of those of that succession, Britain, America, so I say the succession is Britain, America, Globish.
I'm Elliot Forrest, filling in for Leonard Lopate. Today I'm speaking with Robert McCrum. His book is Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. What did the Magna Carta, why was that a turning point?
Magna Carta was a turning point because it was the first time that the English people, I mean, this is history, not language, that this is the first time the English people imposed their will on the monarch. And this is the other thing about the story. The English has kind of encoded within it ideas of freedom, ideas of self-expression, ideas of the rights of the individual, and this goes back a long way. And so, in a way, it's like a benign virus which spreads ideas of freedom and so forth around the world wherever it goes. And the Magna Carta was the first time the people said to the king, "Oh, you can't do that. We're going to write down," or rather, he wrote down what he couldn't do, and they. And it was signed off by the barons and so forth. And it's now virtually, it's a very little read document, in fact. But it does contain the famous habeas corpus, the right of the accused not to be detained unlawfully. And much of the debate about torture in Iraq and all those fierce debates in America go back to Magna Carta and even earlier than that. And they go back to a time when the English people were very assertive about their rights. What you could and couldn't do, and there's a good history to that. But it's you're reduced to eventually to things like national character. The thing about the English is that they are very prickly and difficult in some ways, as indeed are the Americans to a degree.
You have so many great stories about individuals, these major turning points, seemingly small days that turn into amazing events. William Caxton, tell us who he was.
Well, Caxton was I love Caxton. He's a great guy. He is he's the first printer. Well, he's not the first printer. The first printer was his contemporary, a man called Gutenberg, who died. Who invented printing and then died broke and unrecognized before his invention came to fruition. Caxton was an Englishman. He was a very colorful. He was a civil servant. He was a diplomat. He was an amateur writer, translator, and he's like a man who discovered word processing at the age of 50. And he suddenly
came. And what year is this?
This is in 1475. It's a long time ago. And it's just like somebody who discovered word processing last week. It's somebody who'd been given an iPad you imagine somebody who'd never done word processing, been given an iPad last week. And he gets a printing press, and he cannot believe his luck because he's been writing out versions in handwriting again and again and again. And suddenly there's a way of mass producing his translations. And he was a serious translator. And he was and he's important because he's the first person to, as it were, to begin to codify the language. And in those days, a word like knight, N-I-G-H-T, would have been pronounced nicht.
From the German.
From the German. But it was, and it was, say it was spelled nicht, N-I-G-H-T. And this codification, which took place in 1475, is what we're stuck with. I mean, you might say logically, it would be better to say N-I-T-E. You're absolutely right. But Caxton, and there are hundreds of examples, so through, T-H-R-A-U-G-H, very hard for some foreigner to understand, goes back to Caxton again. There are many other examples.
I also love the story. You tell it as starting it as a morning breakfast that we ended up having this dictionary from Samuel Johnson.
He's another of my heroes. He was a giant of common sense. He was just very commonsensical. He was, another amateur. The other thing about this story is English, you know, we're all experts, but we all speak English, so we're all experts. And no one has a greater right than anybody else to assert themselves. And Johnson, who was a fine figure from the 18th century and roughly contemporaneous with Benjamin Franklin, say, he was given a commission, publisher's commission, to do a dictionary. The idea of the dictionary was it would give the rising middle class a kind of guidebook to having better words, new words, and better definitions. And unlike the French, the French had a commission of 40 people working on the French dictionary for 40 years, in fact. When Dick Johnson got his commission, Johnson said, "I'll do it myself," and he got a bunch of researchers essentially, and took a house in the middle in Fleet Street. You can still see it actually, off in Gough Square in Fleet Street, and set up a table and began to write some incredible number of definitions. Some of them very famous, some of them very comical.
Talk about the comic part of it, only because you'd think he might take it seriously and just try to be exact, but in some cases he's got a humorous take on a couple of things. Did I catch you off guard a little bit?
Just let me find the, there are a couple here which I want to quote correctly, so it'd be a shame to get it wrong.
Why don't we take a little break and then we'll come back. We'll find that and we'll hear that and we'll continue. I'm Elliot Forrest filling in for Leonard Lopate. We're talking to Robert McCrum about his book Globish: How the English Language Became the World's Language. It's published by W.W. Norton and Company, and we'll have more after a break. Elliot Forrest sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Robert McCrum. His new book is called Globish: How the English Language Became the World's Language. Before the break, we were talking about Samuel Johnson. No, he wrote a dictionary, and he was rather whimsical with some of these definitions.
But he was an amateur, and he made up the dictionary as he went along, and he was whimsical indeed. One of his dictionary definitions was of a lexicographer itself, and he wrote it was a writer of dictionaries, a harmless drudge. And then a very famous one for oats, a grain which in England is generally given to horses and in Scotland supports the people.
That's great. And part of what was interesting too to me is that this is actually a continuation of English being rather flexible.
Very flexible.
Whereas I think you mentioned in the book, the French dictionary that came out at the time sort of solidified things.
Well, absolutely. And the point about the story of Globish, English, global English, is that compared to the French, whenever the French, because after all, the French had an empire, they had an empire partly in North America and all over the world. wherever the French went, it was always top down, and it was always from on high. It was, French was imposed by the Grands Écoles, by Paris, by the authorities, and English has always been the language of the common man. It came from bottom up, and the American poet Walt Whitman has a very good description of this in the preface to his famous collection of poems, Leaves of Grass. And I'll just read a very short bit. Whitman said, "The English language is not an abstract construction of dictionary makers. It is the powerful language of resistance. It is the dialect of common sense. It is the speech of the proud and the melancholy races and of all who aspire." And this is the key bit. He says, "It has its basis, broad and low, close to the ground. It is very democratic. And it belongs to the ordinary people. It belongs to every man, every woman. And it is democratic, and it carries ideas of freedom, ideas of self-expression, and it's not a remote thing. It doesn't belong to high ups and posh people and academics."
For a lot of people, and I go back to when I was in high school, I took French, and one of the reasons I took French is I think if you were to guess maybe 25 years ago, you would have guessed that French might have been the international language. You're going to be a diplomat. It might be the language that you needed to know to go around the world. It didn't happen is really the heart of what your book is about.
In a sense, I mean, when the EU, the European Union, was set up, it was set up Anglo-French. And all the document, this is still true, all the documentation that comes out of Brussels is produced both in English, has to be by statute, has to be produced both in English and in French. And they're supposed to debate and discuss everything in English and French. It's completely withered away. Because the new states who have joined the EU from the so-called accession states from the Eastern Europe all use Globish. That's what they turn to.
Tell us what the Man Booker Prize is and why that's significant here.
Well, the Man Booker Prize is like your Pulitzer Prize. It's a very important literary prize, and
in England,
England, and it's a very odd prize in one significant way. You can be submitted for it as a novel. It's for novels. You can be submitted for it from all over the so-called Commonwealth, that's to say Australia, South Africa, Canada, Ireland, anywhere. But you can't be submitted from America. If you're an American writer, so Philip Roth can never be entered for the Booker Prize. But Salman Rushdie, Peter Carey in Australia, a whole range, Michael Ondaatje in Canada, and other well-known writers, they can be submitted for it. And over the last, it's been running for about 40 years. And when it began, almost all the winners were English, from the British Isles, and or maybe from Australia, but essentially they were UK. There were no Americans, of course. And now, what's happened in the last 40 years is there's a much wider range, and so the people who are the writers who are winning it are using Nigerian English, South African English, a whole range of different. Singaporean English, and famously Indian English, writers like Vikram Seth, Rushdie, and so forth.
Let's spend some time on India, because that's a significant country in establishing English as the global language. Why is that?
Well, India is very important because it was settled by the English, colonized by the English and the French, and the English took control of it pretty quickly in the 18th century. And they established an educational system, railways, schools, road, and it was a whole infrastructure. And they anglicized, you know, India is a subcontinent. It's not really a country. It's a patchwork of, you know, something like 20 languages. And Indians, even to this day, Indians who speak one mother tongue, like say Gujarati, couldn't communicate with Indians who are speaking from another part of the subcontinent. And so during the Raj of the British Empire, English became the way of communicating, and in some senses, the Indians took to this like ducks to water. They loved it, and to this day, you hear a very good version of English being used in India, thanks partly to schools and universities.
It didn't surprise me as I was reading your book that I think the National Spelling Bee was on recently on American television on a major network, and the winner was from India.
Yeah, no surprise at all, because they probably went to an Indian school where they taught English very well, and they probably would have come over here. And that's an example of how global capitalism is. There's an example of an Indian who aspiring to do better would have brought his language or her language, I don't know whether it was a boy or a girl, but anyway, would have come over here to benefit from the economic opportunities of the USA, but they would benefit because they had they had a means of communicating, and that they're very well trained. And what you see in India today, which you don't see in China, is you see a new middle class rising up from this kind of from global capitalism. So a city like Bangalore is like a kind of mini version of California. It has Infosys, Unisys. It has all these call centers and all these computer centers, which are being staffed and run by Indians who are taught to communicate with the wider world, often in very so they will be taught New York English in their training schools or Australian English, and they're taught to communicate by telephone.
You tell a great story in a book, your book Globish, about Slumdog Millionaire. I felt more than anything I'd really come to understand India through that movie. Yet you view this more as a Globish movie.
Well, it was written by an Indian, actually a diplomat who'd been very well educated, obviously. It was, the script was originally called Q&A, and it was a book which did no real business. And it came out.
The book before the movie.
It was came out as Q&A, got a few reviews, and then a very clever film company, very clever indeed, I think, spotted its potential, and they commissioned an Englishman to turn this Indian writer's novel into a script, which was then taken up by Danny Boyle, who's a Scotsman, who then went to Mumbai to commission an Indian cast. They cast it with Indians and you have a range of English there, which is indeed Globish. And so, in a way, the movie is a kind of Globish phenomenon. And then it won the Oscar. So then it's come full circle.
An American prize.
So you've got all the, thank you very much. Yes.
I'm Elliot Forrest, filling in for Leonard Lopate today. We're talking to Robert McCrum about his book, Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. Let's jump ahead to more modern times. You really describe how Netscape changed a lot of things for us when we're able to browse the internet.
Yeah, the World Wide Web is absolutely crucial, I think, in the story. I mean, global capitalism, which comes after the crucial date in the making of global, I think, is the end of the Cold War, 1989, the end of the Soviet Union, the fall of the wall, and this long 10-year period of sustained growth, combined with technological transformation of the IT revolution, Netscape, the World Wide Web, and all of that, plus this long boom, capitalist boom, which obviously came to an end 2 years ago, but for a long time the era of boom and bust seemed to be over, and global capitalism spread all over the world, and people were using the new technology as a way of communicating, and to an incredible degree, to something like 70% of all the transactions on the World Wide Web are in English.
70%.
Something like I wouldn't put my hand on the Bible on that, but it's some very high figure.
You have a quote in the book that you said, "English plus Microsoft equals a new cultural revolution."
I think that's true.
You also talk about, and this was amazing to me, non-English speaking major corporations adopting English as the official language of their companies.
Yeah.
This cannot have gone down easy with all the employees.
Well, there's a famous example. Oh, there are several examples. The European one is a truck company called Iveco, which has – this is a way back, actually. This was almost pre at this time I'm describing, but it was the money came from France, Italy, Germany. Not England, actually. France, Italy, Germany, I think Scandinavia. And it was set up – it was a dominantly Italian company. And it was set up and all the in-house memos were in English. But it was set up as an English language company, as a way of making better communications internally. Although there are different branches, one in Rome, there's one in Paris, and all the internal communications are, and I'm sure at the time it went down badly, but it's now very well established, and they're perfectly happy using English as a way of communicating.
And some German companies, I think, as well.
There are quite a few, yes. Yeah.
Let's break down some other companies and new phenomenons. Let's talk about television, for example, and the effect of CNN in spreading global English.
Well, there's a very nice story of CNN. This is a life and death story of Globish and CNN. When the 7/7 bombings went off in London, this is a true story, which I heard from a friend of mine who is a former school teacher, and he runs an academy in London. And this is an international academy, and it has Greek, it has Italian, it has Arab, it has Japanese, Chinese, it has all kinds of students all over the world. And on the day of the 7/7 bombings, one of his students in southwest London tried to get a bus to go to his class in the city. And the buses sorry, a tube, an underground train. The tube wasn't running. So he, because the bombs had begun to go off and they closed the tube down. So he gets onto a bus. He's on the bus going in from southwest London to the city when his cell phone, his mobile phone goes off, and it's a friend in Athens, a non-English speaking, a Greek friend who's his command of English is probably quite limited, who calls his Arab friend in London. He says to his Arab friend, what they're saying on CNN is that the buses have become targets for a terrorist attack. So this chap, this Arab guy, gets off the bus, walks away down the road. As he walks away down the road, the bus blows up. And everyone was killed.
That's unbelievable. A couple of listeners have asked about the rise of Chinese.
Yes.
And
yes.
Could it unseat English as the global language, or are they learning English as well?
Well, they are. I mean, here's an amazing statistic. There are in China 350 million people, 350 million people learning English today. And that's close to the same. That's roughly the same figure that speaks it as a mother tongue around the world, as a mother tongue. And I've been to China. I've seen, and it's a very entertaining thing to watch, because they learn English in football stadium, and they're taught
football, meaning soccer here.
In stadiums,
right?
And the teacher stands in the middle with a megaphone, and he'll say, "Good morning, Leonard," and the crowd goes, the whole crowd goes, "Good morning," and then he says, "How are you today?" And they go, "How are you?" And so they learn it by rote. It's insane. And they don't really understand, to be honest with you, it's not really understood, but it is acquired in some limited way. I think the reason why it won't go outside China is because I think it seems to stay inside, and the Chinese show no interest, really, in spreading their culture and their language outside of, you know, they have a very Middle Kingdom complex or Middle Kingdom understanding. They have seen themselves at the center of the world. They're utterly self-sufficient in many respects. You know, they are the Chinese, and a very proud and distinguished civilization going back thousands of years. They're indifferent to the wider world, and their language reflects that. It's
not a missionary.
It's not a viewpoint with
their language.
No, and there's no. I mean, and Chinese is opaque, isn't it? It gives off no. It doesn't speak to us, at least not in characters, because it's unintelligible.
This was actually in your documentary about the story of English, and I just wanted to ask if this was still true, that all air traffic controllers speak English.
They do. And
globally? Everywhere, even in China?
They use airspeak. But anecdotally, I've heard he said that Italian pilots, I should be a bit careful here, but the Italian pilots returning to Rome always default doing Italian. So when they get within range of the Italian airfields, they switch to Italian and they speak to the traffic control.
When they're en route other places.
Yeah, apparently. I'm not sure.
It's all English.
What's known as a fact too good to check.
I think the most obvious evidence of this globalization of English for me is that it seems such an increased tendency to see leaders of different countries, whether it's an Arab country or an African country, an Asian or even a Soviet country, all speaking English on news clips.
Absolutely, yeah. And for example, yes, that's true. But, and there's a good case in the case of the invasion of Georgia, where Michael Saakashvili, if I can pronounce it correctly, who is the president of Georgia, mounted a very successful counterattack against the Russian tanks, a propaganda war, which he effectively won in August 2008, because he and his cohorts around him were all American educated. They all been to Harvard and Yale and the rest of it, and they were very articulate. And they went on the airwaves, and they went on to CNN, and they spun a tale of poor Georgia being oppressed by the brutish Russian bear in English, and this went around the world, and it was very effective. That's a classic example.
What's the effect of the BlackBerry been?
Well, the BlackBerry in China. Well, I mean, again, going back to China, the fact of the BlackBerry with its you know, the QWERTY keyboard,
right,
which doesn't really work obviously in Chinese, has sponsored a boom in English language learning in China, because the aspiring middle class Chinese students want to use the BlackBerry, so they have to switch to English to use the BlackBerry.
And I guess the shorthand is all English in a way.
Texting,
LOL,
absolutely,
OMG.
Yeah, texting, yeah.
It's all based on English, right?
Yeah.
Wikipedia has its critics. You defend it in your book.
Yeah, I mean people make jokes about Wikipedia, but I think it's a wonderful resource. And if you know enough about something, and if you just want to check something, if you already know something about the subject, and you just want to check a fairly salient date or fact, it's very useful. And I used it when I was doing the book.
But because you can actually translate it now into many other languages, and initially when we talked about Netscape and Microsoft, so much was in English, and now things are translating. Do you actually think Globish is a short-term phenomenon and that everyone will go back to their own language?
I'm very wary of predictions, because people who make predictions about language almost always prove wrong. When I did the story of English 25 years ago, The common prediction then was that the world would break up into so-called new Englishes, Latin broke up into French, Spanish, and Portuguese, and so on, Italian, and that in the near future, all the academics were saying the likelihood is that English would break up into these mutually unintelligible varieties. Didn't happen. So if you ask me what I'm inclined to say, but I don't think it's really a prediction. I'm inclined to say that I think that given international capitalism and continuing IT evolution in the way that we've had it, the chances are that Globish will flourish and survive and do very well. But, I mean, who knows?
We've just got a couple of minutes left. Let me just ask you, call me optimistic, but does freedom and democracy actually follow the global use of English?
I'd like to say yes to that. I'm an optimist too. I think because the language, as I say, kind of embodies these ideas, the core language, you know, freedom, which free and free speech, and all these concepts are kind of woven into the prehistory of the subject. There is a tendency for these ideas to flourish and take root as the language itself spreads. But this is controversial ground. I mean, Noam Chomsky, for example, would be horrified to hear this, because for him or for academics, language is neutral and is value free. But I say that language is not value free, and mother tongue language, the language of the mother tongue, is very, very potent when it spreads.
You get biblical in your epilogue. You quote Genesis saying that the whole earth is of one language and of one speech.
I was running ahead because people. One of the things people say when this subject comes up is this: the end of Babel. In the myth of Babel, is the world is broken up into 5,000 languages, or many more. And I conclude. So I cite the Babel story, because it seems to me that one thing that people might say is, well, with Globish, you know, this is the end of Babel. It's not. Because, as I say, the world is still a patchwork of many, many, many nationalisms, and long may it remain that way, I say, and because those nationalisms will have local cultures, local languages, local is good, but at the same time, there will also be a kind of thin layer of this default language, Globish, to which people will turn in a crisis. And I think the fact that there will be more international communication through it may encourage, you know, peace and harmony, and I just hope so.
I've been speaking with Robert McCrum about his book Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. It's published by W.W. Norton and Company. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.